Thanks for joining us. I'm Jerry Kenny, WYSO and Kettering Fairmont High. Now present a Reader's Theater production of If I Were You by L. Ron Hubbard. The performance you're going to hear was recorded earlier in September. It features students from Kettering Fairmont High, Pete Scalia from ABC 22 and Fox 45, and a very special guest known by millions around the world as the voice of Bart Simpson, Dayton native Nancy Cartwright. We'll hear from our student performers during tonight's intermission, but we also had a chance to sit down for a chat with Nancy during her visit here. You'll get to hear some of that conversation throughout the show. She begins by telling us how this performance came about.
I have to take it back to when I first met Ross Taylor. He's one of the teachers at Kettering Fairmont, and I just adore this man, and actually his wife, Ann, too. She's a makeup artist. They sort of took me under their wings. I had come back here in 2005, I think. I wrote a book in 2000 called My Life as a 10-Year-Old Boy, and I came back to do a one-woman show that's based on that book. And I decided, you know, I'd like to do this, but I want to get the community involved. So we'll charge $10 a pop, have them come see my show, and we'll create that. I put a scholarship together and decided that, you know, the money will go towards the Nancy Cartwright Endowment. It's an artistic endowment. And it's to forward students to go to Ohio University. We've got this fabulous relationship between Kettering Fairmont and Ohio University to give kids a little leg up, because that's what I got. Anyway, Ross was just like, took care of me while I was here and kind of came on board. He's also the director of the theater productions there. He's a fabulous guy. And we just started talking, and he's come out to L.A. every time I do a fundraiser, he and his wife, and are generous with their time. And I don't know, they help me, I help them, and it's a good relationship. So they were out there visiting, and I had done this book on tape, and we're talking about it, and I'm thinking, my gosh, maybe there's a way that we could do this as a Reader's Theater production. And the creative juices started flowing, and we both came up with this idea. We got in touch with the publisher, Galaxy Press, and they got involved, and next thing you know, we created this this event. And the whole thing is actually done very professionally, and I think there's a ninth grader that's playing my wife. I'm playing a guy. I'm playing a little guy named Little Tom Little, who's a midget in a circus. You got your ringmaster, you got the professor, a guy who's dying. It's a great suspense story of a fellow who inherits these books, that he learns how to transfer his soul into the body of someone else. I don't want to give it away, but it's kind of a suspenseful and surprising turn of events.
Nancy Cartwright. And now, Kettering Fairmont High's production of If I Were You.
Fittingly, it was a dark and blustery night when the professor died. The summer storm had come yelling in from a scorching afternoon to tear at canvas and yank out stakes and stab bright fury at the big top. The rain bucketed down with a shock of coldness and then settled to a ceaseless cannonading, which, after 7 hours, had turned the lot into a swamp so tenacious that not even the rubber mules could budge the wagons. Banners wept from their staffs, lot lice shivered in scant cutter. Somewhere, a big cat, excited by the tropical aspect of the storm, moaned and paced in his cage. And although a waxen yellowness was already upon his face and his skin was falling away from his bones, the professor managed an evil smile. He was waiting, hanging on and waiting. For he had sent half an hour since for Little Tom Little, king of the midgets. And as he waited, his thoughts roamed over the past, the better to savor what he was about to do. The professor was the gypsy camp's bird of bad omen. Whence he had come, no man knew, but with him had come a chain of disaster. Tall and bony, he had always been more a cadaver than a man. His scummed eyes hid behind thick, dark lids. His hands always seemed ready to throttle a victim. His black hair was matted about his face, just as his clothes were matted about his form. He had come as a mit reader. Mrs. Johnson had not wanted to take him, but boss of the show, though she was, she had not been able to refuse him. Hermann Schmidt, ringmaster and governor de facto, powerful figure though he was, had been unable to resist the eerie command of those eyes. And the man had become the professor to the gypsy camp and Yogi Matto to the chumps. There had been uneasy speculation about him for weeks, for the breaks had been many and all bad. But men were afraid of him and said nothing, as though finding flavor in his tidings, he had accurately forecast each and every disaster, even to this storm which kept the crowds away tonight. And weirdly, he had forecast, again with relish, his own death. Some had said he was a Russian, but then a Hindu had come out of the crowd, and the two had spoken in the Hindu's tongue. And when they had dubbed him as being from India, they found that he spoke Chinese and Turkish as well. A Razorback had once seen the insides of his trunks and had pronounced their heaviness occasioned by fully 100 books of ancient aspect filled with mysterious signs and incantations. That the professor did possess some remarkable power was apparent to all, for no matter how much anger might be vented against him for driving clients into hysteria with his evil forebodings of their future and thus hurting the show, no man had ever been able to approach those eyes. No man, that is, but Little Tom Little. Just how this was, even the professor could not tell. But from the first, Little Tom Little, an ace at the heartless act of mimicry, had found humor in the professor and had won laughter by mocking him. The matter had developed into nearly an open feud, but Little Tom Little, inwardly caring desperately what the world thought of him, but outwardly a swaggering satirist, had continued merrily. The mockery always went well with the crowd, just as the professor did not. Little Tom Little, in the sideshow, would get the crowd after the professor was done, and very cunningly would tell their fortunes in a doleful voice which made the tent billow from the resulting laughter. These crowds, sensing evil, had not liked to believe what the professor had said. And the gypsy camp had laughed with Little Tom Little, even though no man but he dared to affront the professor. The professor had not forgotten his powerlessness to turn aside those quips. He had not forgotten that a man just 30 inches tall had held him up to ridicule for months. He had said nothing. But he was dying now, and he was glad to die, secure as he was in a knowledge of the glories which awaited him elsewhere. In dying, he would find himself at last. But he could not forget Little Tom Little. No, he would remember Little Tom Little with a legacy. He had already made out the paper. Someone was coming up the aisle of the car, and then the doorknob rattled, and Little Tom Little entered the stateroom. Water ran from his tiny poncho as he took it off. The professor moved a little on his pillow so that he could see his visitor, whose head was just above the height of the bunk. Little Tom Little's handsome self, usually so gay, was now steeped in seriousness. He felt that he ought to feel highly sympathetic, and yet he could not understand exactly why, out of the whole crew, he had been sent for at this moment. For the physician outside had told him the professor couldn't last long. He was repelled, as always, by those filmed eyes. For Little Tom was not a brave man for all his front. He waited for the professor to speak.
"You are wondering,"
said the professor,
"why I have sent for you."
His voice was very low, and Little Tom had to put his ear close to the evil-smelling lips.
"In your mind, you are turning over the reasons for this. I must put you at ease, for I have always respected you."
Little Tom was startled.
"Yes, I have seen much to admire in you. On the lot about me, men are afraid. They spread away from me when I approach. But you were brave, Tom Little. You did not cower away. You had steel enough in you not only to meet me and speak to me, But you also had courage enough to risk my wrath. A thing which all other men feared.
Little Tom had not considered that his mockery required so much nerve.
It was not courage.
He protested, trying to say something decent to a dying man.
You just imagined.
No, I did not imagine. Men slink from me for a peculiar reason, little Tom. They slink from me because I impel them. Yes, that is the truth. I force them away. I want nothing to do with men, for I loathe all mankind. I impelled them, little Tom Little. Long before now, you must have realized that I command strange and subtle arts beyond the understanding of these foolish and material slaves of their own desires.
Whatever Little Tom Little had expected to hear from a dying man, this certainly was far from it. In common with everyone, he had suspected these things, but he had been urged to derision instead of terror, not through understanding, but by nature.
By such command,
continued the professor,
I am now able to leave this world for one far better, knowing exactly where I am going. But behind me, I shall leave a little more than a corpse. I have a few things here.
Oh, you're not going to die,
said Little Tom Little.
If I believed that, I should be very sad,
replied the professor.
But to return to why I brought you here, you must know that I was unable to make any impression upon you.
Well, I never felt any.
Oh, that is it. I cannot touch you. And that means that you have it subconsciously in your power to handle and control all phases of the black arts.
Me?
You! And I appreciate this. I respect you for it. I have a generous heart, little Tom, for I am a learned man and can understand all things. Behind me, I shall leave my books. They are ancient and rare, and most of them in mystic languages. But I have translated many of the passages into English. These volumes contain the black lore of the ancient peoples of the East. Only a few men have any notion whatever of the depths of such wisdom, of the power to be gained through its use. And you, little Tom, are to be my heir. The paper here is witnessed. I give it to you.
Little Tom took the sheet and glanced wonderingly from it to the professor.
You did not believe I was truly your friend. Now, what greater proof is there than this legacy so freely given? Does that prove my good regard, little Tom?
Well, yes, sure.
When I am dead, then, add my trunks to your own baggage. Study my volumes well. Can I give you any greater gift than wisdom?
I don't know what to say. This is so much.
Do not mention it, please. It is a little thing, for I shall need them no longer. Now go, for in the few minutes which remain to me, I wish to concentrate all my powers upon the world which lies awaiting me.
Little Tom was still so astonished that he stumbled going to the door. Somehow he got into his poncho and fumbled up the aisle. After a little, he found he still gripped the paper in his minute hand and put it away. He was upset to such an extent that he went down the train, not remembering to get off and seek his own car. And so it was that he opened the door to Hermann Schmidt's private car and was halfway down it before he realized where he was. And then it was too late. Hermann Schmidt, as ringmaster and tacit governor of Johnson's Super Shows, was known to have the temper of a Prussian drill sergeant and, as a near giant, could afford give it vent. He was sitting at a writing table, checking piles of currency into a capacious tin box. So pleasant did the task appear that not until the door, held for a time by the hydraulic shock absorber, closed, that he realized that his sanctum sanctorum had been invaded. Schmidt whirled like a bull, suddenly stabbed from behind, and came half to his feet, gripping the chair as though about to hurl it. But he looked in vain for a moment, for he instinctively searched a level about 2 feet over little Tom's head, where a normal man's face would have been. And then he saw little Tom, who in this crisis was paralyzed by the ringmaster's terrible wrath, which seemed all out of proportion to so small a crime. With a hair-singeing oath in German, Schmidt expressed both relief and rage. He lunged forward and grabbed little Tom by the front of his poncho, lifting him bodily 3 feet off the floor as he might a sawdust doll.
So, you are spying!
And little Tom was shaken so violently that he could not have answered, even if Schmidt's grip and the resulting strain on the poncho were not choking him. Little Tom, even in this instant of terror, couldn't comprehend why Schmidt should be so mad.
You think this is a runway? You come in. Maybe you think you own this show. Maybe you just bought it. Maybe Mrs. Johnson just you gave it. A lesson you need, you tent of a human being.
And as though he was putting out a cat, he rushed to the vestibule, little Tom dangling high, and with a final ferocious shake, lifted him over the edge and let him fall 8 feet down to the mud. Little Tom was stunned. He could hear Schmidt's voice far away, bidding him to let himself be taught so to walk around the next time he came to this car. Dimly, he saw Schmidt up on the car platform, much as a drowning sailor might have seen the Colossus of Rhodes. Little Tom dazedly pried himself out of the mud. His shoulder was full of lightning, and he could barely support even his meager weight upon his twisted ankle. In him, a rage was kindled, to run along like a dot of fire, eating the length of a fuse which was to burn for weeks ere it reached the dynamite.
Well, if I have to be a midget another minute,
cried little Tom Little,
I'll use a stretcher on myself.
And indeed, he sounded very desperate, sitting there on his stage in the heat of the newly deserted tent. Somewhere at hand, the circus band was oompaing in preparation for the entrance of Gordon.
The world's greatest vile animal trainer, who performs the suicidal feat of putting through their paces 20 ferocious tigers from Bengal and 20 man-eating lions, all at one and at the same time. Ladies and gentlemen!
Little Tom Little winced as the faraway spiel reached him. How he hated cats. Maisie was putting away their paraphernalia and looking sad. Only an inch taller than little Tom Little, she felt his recriminations against his own lot somehow damned hers. And then, too, he was handsome, and he had wit, and tiny though he was, there existed no better showman in the gypsy camp than himself.
I'm sick of it,
said little Tom with even greater emphasis.
But why?
Said Maisie, shutting down the lid of the small trunk and making things ready for the next act.
You're a genius, Tommy. Of all the sideshows, yours and mine draws best. You know how to keep them.
Keep them?
Shouted Tommy, leaping up to all his 30 inches of height.
Who wants to keep them? Who wants to stand up here day after day with them, packed up against this stage, rubbering and giggling and sweating and saying, oh, ain't he cute, Joe? And, oh, ain't she the dearest thing, Martha? Why do they like us? I'll tell you why. Because we're freaks! That's right. It isn't because we're good. It isn't because I give them a show. I'm a freak. See? A freak!
The outburst subsided, and he sank back into the small chair. Some of the other attractions glanced toward him from the remote platforms. Maisie patted his shoulder consolingly.
Tommy, it's better to be the best midget star in the world than a failure as a big person.
It's not. I'd rather dig ditches. If I could stand up and look at my fellow man in the eye instead of examining his shins.
But, Tommy, that's senseless. No matter how hard you wish it, it will never come true. You're a midget, and a very handsome one, and you're an artist.
How do I know I'm an artist? No matter how I work my act, I'll never know that. I'm cute and darling and...
Tommy, if you want to leave the show...
No! Who's talking about leaving the show? I know the business, and not all the Schmidts in the world could drive me away.
Has he done something to you lately?
It's not what he does. It's what he doesn't do.
There he is, a ringmaster. Do you think he'll ever notice a midget? Huh? I've tried to ask him for a spot in the big tent, and you know what? Time after time, he's almost walked me down. If I was a big person...
He clenched his small fists bitterly.
He thinks he's a showman. Why, for all the brass in his voice, I could make a fool out of him in 10 minutes in his own ring. Oh, someday, I'm going to look up at the boss and I'm going to say, Mrs. Johnson, I want to be the ringmaster.
So that's it again. Tommy, you know that will never be.
Why not?
Said Tommy darkly.
The ringmaster runs the show, and I am tired of being a freak. You wait, Maisie. You wait. One of these days, I'll be the ringmaster.
Tommy.
What now?
Tommy, you haven't been reading those books again, have you?
What books?
Tommy, don't be that way with me. When the professor left you his trunks, he didn't like you any better than he ever had.
What of that? Can a man repent on his deathbed?
Yes, Tommy. But did he?
Look, let's not go into that.
He hated you, Tommy. When he used to mimic his mitt reading, I could see him watching. He didn't think it was funny. It may be all right with anyone else in the show for you to take off the routine, but it never was with the professor.
You're dreaming again. He did leave me the trunks, didn't he?
There's such a thing as vengeance after death, Tommy.
Well, sure, but I haven't met his ghost yet.
Not his ghost, Tommy. It's those books.
Late that night, Maisie lay wide awake and apparently sound asleep in the dark of the stateroom berth, fearfully watching Tommy, the king of the midget showmen, who didn't want his crown, sitting gnome-like at the dressing table, surrounded by a litter of cracked and weighty tomes whose parchment pages were like mummy's skin in the gloom. The book he was studying was so unwieldy that he had propped it up with grease paint cans to save his arms. Maisie wanted badly to weep, to cry out, to plead with him and tell him how much he meant to her, but she lay like some perfect doll put away and forgotten by a careless child. She had been with him for 5 years on the sawdust trail, and each day she found something new about him. The world pushed so heavily against him, and his tiny body was so frail and his spirit so great that she would have given her very heart to have been a big person and able to defend him. To the world of superlative polysyllables and sawdust, Little Tom Little was known for an ace. As a half-pint punchinello who dared to deride them all, he had gained much fame. None of them knew that the dapper vest pocket edition longed for anything but to keep his name properly on the posters. Had they known, they probably would have laughed at him about it, and they probably would have howled over his ambition to be a ringmaster. But only Maisie knew. Only Maisie had seen him in a deserted tent, cracking a long whip around his tiny black boots and putting imaginary rosinbacks through their paces. And Maisie, all was not well with Tommy, and so nothing was well with her. A big cat was howling his displeasure somewhere along the train, and Maisie saw Little Tom Little fidget uneasily. How he had hated the big fellow since that break in Kansas City when the lion had almost killed him. And seeing him wince at the sound, Maisie felt willing to go and gag the animal if it would give Tommy a little rest. What would he dig from those volumes? The danger of a cat was as nothing to the knowledge he so eagerly gulped. Everyone had known the professor as a misfit, and more than one had breathed a sigh of relief when he had passed into what he had described as a glowing land of happiness. But wherever he had gone, he had left evil memories behind him. He had been a vulture of bad omen, a cadaver without a coffin, a man whose eyes gleamed at the tidings of misfortune. He had lived on bad luck, had purveyed ominous forebodings to cringing clients, and his lot had not been easy. Had he been far more than a sideshow mitt reader, and when Tommy, impartial as always, had taken to giving a mimic mitt act to take off the professor, Maisie had known that someday Tommy would pay for humbling a vicious pride. Tommy's act had been funny, but now, why had the professor left those books, his entire library, to Tommy? The big cat roared more loudly, and Tommy impatiently leaped up to wrestle the window down. Reaching thus across Maisie, he saw that she did not sleep.
Anything wrong?
She saw how abstracted he was.
Nothing.
You feel all right, don't you?
Yes, certainly.
Tommy kissed her thoughtlessly and went back to his book. She saw how animated he was, how his small body could scarcely contain the enthusiasm he built up within it. And when he turned, his face flushed and cried,
"Maisie, I've got it!"
It was all she could do to repress a sob of despair. As gaily as she could, she answered,
"What is it, Tommy?"
"The solution! I said today I was never again going to be a midget. Well, I'm not! Tomorrow, I shall be ringmaster of the show!"
Her alarm was real, but she masked it.
How do you mean, Tommy?
Why, it's here. It's all here. This is a treatise on the transmigration of the soul. You understand that, don't you? When a fellow kicks off, he enters into another body, see? It's a wonder I never found this before. It's all marked, and there was a slip of paper between the pages. Say, maybe the professor wasn't such a bad egg after all, huh? He said when he left me all these that he'd indicated one place, specially. This must be it.
Oh, Tommy, are you sure it won't mean?
But Tommy's excited voice swept on, and his 30 inches of height seemed to double themselves already.
It says, if the transmigration of the soul can be effected after death, it's logical to conclude that it can be done in life. It says the only vital thinking portion of a man is his soul energy, and then it can be projected from one body to another. Maisie, think what that means.
She took heart, for he seemed to have nothing definite, but Tommy sent her faint hopes tumbling.
And here's how it's done. How simple. All you have to do is miss a few meals, say breakfast and lunch, and then begin your concentration upon the object in which you desire to transfer. Oh, think about it, Maisie. To leave your body and become another person. To put behind you everything you've done wrong and all the mistakes you've made and begin all over in a different guise.
What happens to the other person?
But he swept that away as well.
Well, naturally, whether he will or no, he's forced to occupy the body you have left or else die.
Tommy, this is dangerous.
But she could not say more, for the possibilities of this terrible idea were overwhelming.
And it's so easy. It says here that if a man becomes everything he senses, even for the briefest of instances, if you have a hero in a story, you are, for the duration of that story, the hero. You take on his mannerisms and his ways of speech. But because he's just a hero of a story, he cannot return that concentration. It says that all men, when talking to other men, are too watchful of the other's words and actions and too conscious of self to achieve this feat. But if one refuses to be aware of the possible menace to self from the other ego, then it is simple to completely assimilate the other person and to project oneself into the other. Oh, think of it, Maisie. If I needed money!
Tommy, this is madness. It cannot possibly work.
Look, Maisie, I have not eaten since noon, and it's now nearing midnight.
What are you going to do?
Maisie, look at me.
No!
Maisie, do you love me?
Oh, Tommy.
And then she felt a curious chill, a feeling as though she'd risen several feet above herself and now hung suspended over her body in the air. But in a moment, she was again in the bed.
It takes practice,
said Tommy, beads of sweat upon his brow.
Look at me, Maisie.
Please, Tommy, for the love of the God that made us.
And she again felt that chill, that feeling of lift. Terror struck at her lest she were blind and deaf. But in a moment, she could begin to see a little and hear the big cat snarling far off. With a start, she found herself gazing not at the dressing table from the bed, but the bed from the dressing table. The big book was heavy against her hand. The curtain of the bed moved as though blown by a gentle breeze. She saw Maisie sit up in the berth. Dazedly, she looked at herself, turned her attention to the body which she now inhabited, not believing the trousers with their tight belt or the tie and collar which choked her. She whirled to the mirror and recoiled at the image of Tommy. Tommy was shaken to the last spark of his consciousness. He was propped up on one elbow, staring in disbelief at the nightdress which he clutched. He came to himself and whipped a hand to his head, the long golden curls. They stared at each other then, silent and numb with awe. When minutes had passed, Tommy laughed shakily.
You see, it works.
But
Tommy, how are we going to get back?
But he was triumphant now and growing bolder.
Why should we?
He teased.
It's horrible, Tommy.
And she was hard put to keep back her tears.
Undo this terrible spell. Please, Tommy.
The longing to be herself made her sight dim. There was a whirling motion about her, and she went blind and feelingless, and then she was shivering, as herself, in the middle of the stateroom, looking at Tommy once more. Suddenly, she threw herself at his feet, trying hard to find the words to tell him that this thing could bring nothing but unhappiness. Tommy hardly noticed her in his excitement.
These are the right words, then. These words written here. It's true. These years of misery are done. No more do I have to step quickly from the path of the big people and look at a man in his shins. Eye to eye, Maisie. And tomorrow...
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
Tomorrow, I shall be ringmaster.
Fairmont High's production of If I Were You will continue in just a moment. First, with most of her job taking place in a sound studio, we wanted to know how Nancy felt about doing live performances.
It's the best. It's totally the best. There's nothing that beats a live performance because the audience sits there, and it's one of the perks of being there. And the audience, to be honest with you, they're very much a part of the production too, because when you do it in a studio, it's just you and the engineers. But when you do it live, you got that instant feedback, you know, and it inspires the artist. It validates what it is that they're doing, that they totally understand the audience is duplicating what is being told, and it's. I mean, you see my face. The public listening to this interview right now don't see it, but you can kind of hear a smile. I get very excited about stuff like this.
You're listening to a Reader's Theater production of If I Were You by L. Ron Hubbard, presented by WYSO and Kettering Fairmont High.
No one ever told me that. Things you need to know about buying a house.
For some, it is the American dream. But I think the real American dream is to be able to live where you can afford to live and live comfortably.
That's really looking at their current income, looking at their credit, seeing if they're ready to go to a lender, being realistic about what they can afford.
Everything costs when you own a home. I mean, everything from lawnmowers to cleaning the gutters to the maintenance of the property.
You know, your furnace is 25 years old. You may not have much longer. Your roof is so many years old.
PMI is private mortgage insurance, along with your property taxes, your homeowner's insurance, which of course you have to have.
The idea is to take your time, get information, don't be taken advantage of. It's risky if you don't do it correctly.
Find the resources you need at thinktv.org and wyso.org. Click Money.
You're listening to member-supported public radio, WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Now, we continue with Fairmont High's production of If I Were You.
Hermann Schmidt arose and dressed with his usual extreme care. His boots had been polished into black mirrors. His stock had been starched into armor plate. His waistcoat had been brushed until it resembled newly shed blood. He set his swallow-tailed coat to perfection upon his mighty shoulders and then, inventorying himself in the mirror, petted his gleaming top hat down upon his broad brow. He selected a crop from a rack, glanced at his watch, and sauntered down the cars to the special diner. As he went, everyone from Razorback to High Traps bowed low, and in return, Schmidt gave them lofty nods, which held a certain amount of doubt, as though he wasn't quite sure they existed. Such was his show day routine. Mighty and domineering, a colossus of size and influence, it was small wonder that the fate of the show rested so certainly in his hands. For who, looking at such a figure of a man, could doubt his ability? He couldn't remember a time when he had not been a man of importance. As a boy, he had been his father's son, and his father had been a ringmaster in the old country. And why shouldn't a man be important if he knew the business from bell ring to stakes? He ended his individual speck at the snowy cloth of his breakfast table, whereon was spread the local morning paper. He disdained such yokel print and sat looking through the car window at the less fortunate denizens of sawdust who trailed toward the crumb castle of the grounds dressed to kick 'em by 10 o'clock. Far away, somebody tuned up a horse piano, and nearby a bull man sicked his rubber mules upon a mired wagon amid much trumpeting and shouting. It was altogether soothing, and Schmidt sighed comfortably. Fried potatoes and a small steak were placed under his nose by an obsequious man, and Schmidt armed himself and prepared to attack. He became conscious of someone who had slid into the seat across the table. He knew who it was and repressed a shudder. Ruefully, he stared at the silver service, which reflected a face in all manner of distortions. The face was ancient and seamed and sallow, and the eyes held an expression which made Schmidt wince. For, certain as he was of most things, he doubted whether he could keep on forever avoiding the necessity of fixing a date for their marriage.
"Good morning, Mrs. Johnson,"
he said with a low bow, and she smiled in a fluttery way.
"How are you today, darling?"
"Very fine. Thank you, Mrs. Johnson."
"Her mom."
She reached out a ruin of a hand and touched the back of his own.
"Must we be so formal? After all, we are engaged."
Forgive me, my lovely one, but I was so engrossed with affairs."
Then inspiration struck.
"Unless we can show a profit on our balance sheets, we mustn't think of our own private affairs. For I promise, I shall never marry you until I can prove my full worth."
"But we are doing such good business."
"Prices are up everywhere,"
he reminded her.
"Our feed bill alone is enough to ruin us. And our licenses have doubled, what with sales tax and all. Ach, mein darling, it is not good. But meet me, I repeat my vow. I shall make a profit before we are man and wife."
"Oh, Hermann, you are so noble."
Hermann smiled in a somewhat sickly fashion and again addressed his steak. She had been such a lovely woman once, he thought. Too bad she hadn't been able to keep the years from rolling over her. She was active, indeed. It was said she could outride any Rosenbach in the show, but that was hardly compensation. He wished desperately for a moment that he had never thought up the idea of proposing to her. But still, he could hold her off a little longer, with skill. And when the final time came, he would leave a note. How she would squirm when she read it. It was his one consoling thought in an otherwise revolting association. He patted her hand in hypocritical affection as he stood up.
"Never mind, my dear. Just leave all this to me. It will show a profit yet."
"If I didn't have you, Hermann."
Hurriedly, he sought the morning outside the car. He stood for a moment, mantling himself with majesty, then strode through the piles of gear toward the grounds. Ahead of him, the tail end of the march was filing into the street to the brassy tune of the steam fiddle and the cloppity-clop of horses' hooves. The grounds were deserted, save for razorbacks, lot lice, a few spielers, and menagerie men. These nodded politely, but since they were not worth notice, Schmidt swept by. With the air of a king entering a palace, he climbed into the wagon, which would ordinarily be the governor's office, but which only he occupied. Easing into a seat at the desk, he unlocked the safe at its side and drew out the books. For the next half hour, he made the art of the show's slip artist seem pale. And as he worked, a stiff smile of lofty satisfaction came upon his face. It went away swiftly when there sounded a knock. He threw the books into the safe and slammed the door. A very beautiful girl timidly entered at his call. She had great soft eyes and long blonde curls, and the loveliness of her figure belied its trained strength.
"Betty,"
he said, pulling out a chair.
"I didn't come to sit down,"
she replied. But nevertheless, he eased her into the seat, Resentfully, but scared, she sat on the chair's edge, staring at him. There was triumph in his voice.
I knew, sooner or later, that you'd come to me of your own accord. After all, it isn't fitting that I should always be the one to arrange meetings.
I came,
she said in a strained tone,
to tell you that this wild plan of yours can't go on.
Nonsense! You have been thinking too much. Don't we love each other? Can't
no!
We?
She cried out.
Don't say that, Ermen. You haven't any right. I have never told you I loved you.
It is enough,
he smiled,
that I love you. And mine plans are your plans. Before long, we will leave this show. You shall divorce Gorton and marry me. We'll be rich. And you shall be more famous than you have ever dreamed.
It's all crazy,
said Betty, trying to withstand the onslaught of his personality.
I've been trying to think straight about this, and I still love Gordon, Ermann. He may be love and vogue-vous.
There was a day when you two had small enough spots.
That was a long time ago. I've worked hard to become an ace. I'm one of your stars. I work hard.
True, you were fortunate in having Gilman kill himself. But of course, if you insist that you will not go with me, you and Gorton can, of course, go together. And the big cats can stay with me. But there's a matter of feed bills for them. And there are many high-wire acts I can get. There's a telegram here somewhere.
And he made a pretense of searching for it.
From Thomas and Mileto, wondering if I could place them. Der Hiver.
I am Zen. Can't go on, Ermann. Give us back our contracts.
Ermann laughed sharply.
Ha! I picked you both out of the mud and taught you everything you know. Did you talk to me this way? But there's one thing you've forgotten. Jerry Gordon is happy just so long as he's playing games with his beloved big kids. He was ruined once. You know what he did. He blamed you for everything and lost all the liquor in sight. And he'd have killed you mid abuse if I hadn't yanked you up out of nothing to start him meet his kids. And you on the high wire.
He didn't mean to be so bad to me. He's a good man, Ermann. He fights 40 big cats all together on the arena. And there isn't another man in the business who can do that. And I have a high wire without a net. And the customer...
Without mine consent, you and Gorton are nothing. Without his ick, he'll drop even lower than he was when I picked you up and stud you both. It would probably kill him, Betty, and you as well.
But he loves me, Elman. What's past is past. It's useless to think of running away with you and divorcing him. Crazy.
And yet if you don't,
said Ermann, smiling,
you'll very much wish you had.
The strain of holding out so long against his will at last broke her own. She began to weep quietly and forlornly, and when at last he cupped her face in his hands and said,
of course you'll go with me, won't you?
She could only nod a weary assent. And leaving his wagon after she had gone, Ermann Schmidt appeared a match for more than a dozen mere lion trainers. An aloof demigod, secure in his realm, proud of his abilities and cunning, he passed the sideshow, with no eyes at all for the midget who stood there, apparently waiting for someone. Little Tom Little was so filled with excitement that he had found great difficulty in breathing. To him, Schmidt was a Brobdingnagian, a Zeus and a Colossus of Rhodes, all super-added into one. And when, in this breath before the 0 minute, he contemplated what he was about to do, he was flabbergasted by his own temerity. Certain he was that Schmidt knew all about it and was about to break his crop on Tommy's small skull. For there he came, as though riding the juggernaut car, gigantic and unstoppable, the science of black magic to the contrary. But so fascinated had Tommy been since the instant of conceiving this bold plan that any passing doubt was drowned in a torrent of enthusiasm. He must time this to the split instant. He must not forget those words which seared his brain. Eagerly he sought Schmidt's eye. Proud to bursting of both his height and bearing, Schmidt was unable to brook even a glimpse of a midget. But eyes are traitorous things which follow anything that moves or sparkles. And as a last resort, Tommy had armed himself with a small silver whip. He swooshed it viciously through the air. Schmidt glanced that way, instantly revolted by the midget's image. To a Razorback who stood languidly by, what followed was not particularly startling, not even to be suspected, for Schmidt merely stopped where he was and appeared to be offended, which wasn't unusual. Little Tom Little was apparently eagerly seeking to say something to the ringmaster, but the two did not exchange a word. The midget's mouth moved as though he talked to himself, and Schmidt looked pop-eyed at such effrontery and, immediately after, somewhat blank. This was the only thing that the Razorback remarked. Schmidt had never looked anything but severe in all circus knowledge, but after an instant of this, Schmidt, getting a grip on himself, it seemed, glanced down to take delighted inventory of his dress. And Little Tom Little, so it appeared, was nothing but disturbed by his own garb. Thereupon Schmidt, swinging his crop and again in a grandiose humor, strolled on his way, and the midget, starting to run after, noticed the Razorback and moved wanderingly into the shadow of the deserted sideshow tent. After the first shock of the transition was over, Little Tom Little felt very much like a bean in a bass drum. When he took a step, he went about four times as far as he thought he should have gone, a fact which occasioned his stumbling over a guy rope and almost losing his dignity in the lap of Matilda, the world's fattest woman. He bowed with great difficulty and again misgauged his distance, almost knocking out his brains against a wagon side. So much further had he gone than he had expected. Feeling embarrassed, he made off. Every day for years he had seen Matilda, and always she had reserved a large smile for him and perhaps some cookies, quite as though she mistook him for a mischievous little boy. And though always he had resented being looked on as a boy, he had never failed to enjoy either the cookies or the smile. But now Matilda looked sober and alarmed, and she had not spoken a word. It was uncomfortable to feel suddenly that he was outside the scope of her kindness, and when he came to consider it, he realized that people were not truly unkind to Little Tom Little. Well, he was not Little Tom Little anymore. He was now Hermann Schmidt, the world's greatest ringmaster, lord and master of Johnson's Super Shows. And what if he did underestimate the length of his step and knock his hat against things he had always found far above him? He would get used to that. And what if Schmidt himself? Tommy had always been insanely jealous of that man's lofty position. Let Schmidt find out how the world looked from a midget's eye and mend his ways accordingly. Having kicked him, the troopers were stringing back from town, sweaty and cross and hungry, anxious to get rested before the afternoon show. Standing in the entrance of the big top, Tommy, as Schmidt, watched them pass. Because he knew that Schmidt always did so, he assumed a somewhat critical air and bowed very seldom. It came to him with a slight shock that people did not fall over themselves to notice him, and when they did, there were scowls. It was a jarring experience to the ex-midget to be scowled upon, for in all his trooping, he had never had anything but smiles for greeting. Well, a fellow had to sacrifice something for his position, didn't he? And yet there was an empty feeling in his soul, and a growing fright that maybe the world suspected something. Had Maisie talked? Had the professor boasted before his death? But no, these frowns were not accusative. These people thought they looked upon Hermann Schmidt, ringmaster. They scowled because they were tired. That was all. Jerry Gordon, riding in a wagon with old Bab, his pet lion, had removed his sun hat to swab at its band when he caught sight of Schmidt. His scowl was deeper, and so filled with suspicion that Tommy was frightened. Gordon has always been the midget's friend, and for all Tommy's hatred of cats. The question was, what did Gordon know? Why did he stop wiping out his hat and frown so heavily that he forgot what his hands were doing? Tommy wished he had taken station anywhere but here. He felt that these people were looking straight through Schmidt, the body of Schmidt, and seeing Little Tom Little, and were all ready to fall upon him en masse and eat him up. Betty, the high-wire artist, riding a bull's howdy, looked strangely at Schmidt as she went by. There was some kind of warning, though a reluctant one in her expression. And Little Tom Little, who had always secretly adored and respected both the girl and her skill, read some distaste in her glance as well. Plainly, though, she was trying to give him a message, and a disquieting one at that. It was all a puzzle to the ex-midget, but overestimating his stride in an attempt to compensate, he again discovered his size and appearance and took heart. Oh, what the devil? Wasn't he Schmidt, the great Schmidt, ringmaster of the Johnson Super Shows? Yes. No longer a midget, small enough to be trod under every foot, but a big person now, and one of the greatest ringmasters in the world. They were afraid of Schmidt. That was it. Schmidt was their master, and now, wasn't he Schmidt? Crossing the lot, he heard a voice call,
Erman!
In sweet accents. It was repeated several times, for he was not yet used to the name. Finally, he realized that the call was for himself, and he turned with a mimicry of Schmidt's reserved air. Mrs. Johnson had always been ready to laugh at little Tom Little's jokes, and now when he saw her regarding him from her tent entrance with a very much different manner, he had to recollect himself very fast to keep from being startled. As yet, he had not had to speak to anyone, and he was frightened at the prospect that his somewhat midgetish voice would betray him. With a guilty manner altogether quite foreign to the true Schmidt, he approached her. Additional dismay came over him when he found that he was expected to make the opening remark. He recollected himself and twirled his mustache as he had often seen Schmidt do, his eyes on the sky.
I think,
he said with careful judging,
that we will have a very fine crowd today.
Erman!
Tommy was alarmed now.
And the act seemed to be in fine shape. I guess if every show we had was as promising as this one, we'd all be rich in no time.
There came a change in her aged face, and he welcomed it.
Things have been like this for the whole season without our getting anything but poorer. Have you some good news of some sort?
Well, you never can tell,
he said vaguely.
You're halting something back,
said Mrs. Johnson with a kittenish air which accused him of teasing her. Tommy regretted he had brought the matter to the front.
No, honest, I didn't mean anything. It's just going to be a good day, I guess. Maybe.
He added brightly,
Maybe I better be getting over to the big top to make sure everything is going all right.
She looked startled, but he moved away too fast to be stopped, said Mrs. Johnson suspiciously. Tommy felt unsettled. He ran a clammy hand over the unaccustomed bushiness of his physiognomy. In the protection of a snack stand, he seated himself upon a box and tried to collect his thoughts. The things he had begun to find out about Erman Schmidt were not at all quieting, and though he had already begun to regret his swap, there was still too much glamour in the thought of being a ringmaster not to give the thing a thorough try. After all, he could last long enough to crack the whip in the main event, and after that, he could let fate take its course. Mealtime had robbed the lot of its attendance for the moment, and so he sat on, waiting for something else to happen. For thought food, he used the fact that the attendance had been getting thin. That had been news, for pay had been regular enough. It amused him the next moment to think that he, Schmidt, would be the one to know the most about such affairs. Presently, the lot began to be popular once more, and feeling conspicuous, he started to move off, wondering where he should go, until it occurred to him that the white wagon, after all, was his. However, his few minutes of rest had spotted him, and promptly he was surrounded by men who had problems to be solved. Although he had the routine of sawdust land at his fingertips, it made him very uncomfortable to be called upon for so many decisions at once. Joe Midler was taking too much strawberry shortcake. His shill wasn't getting a long enough string of coconuts. The pup opera was minus its canine star, who had wandered too near a gravedigger's cage, and it was either a new mutt or a dead hyena. The payoff was too high on a juice joint, and if John Law objected to the kife, what else could a guy do but howl? A kinker had a twisted wrist, and he figured Bill had it in for him anyway since that dame in St. Louis had shown good sense, and he wasn't going to get a broken neck over any fool dame. Tommy dispensed justice as best he could, and twice he turned down out-and-out bribes for a decision, much to the astonishment of the would-be bribers. When things were at last settled and the show was in order, spots had begun and the place was humming with thistlechins. The spielers were clowning the come into what appeared to be a great crowd. People from far and near were already milling near the marquee, and all in all, it was a bright, hot, sweaty, dusty circus day. With bawling barkers all snarled up, with a yelping horse piano, and the jig band in the constant hum of pleased suckers, with an undertone of lions' roars and clacking wheels. Tommy felt better. This was his element, and of this element, he was now king. So delighted was he at the thought of at last snapping the lash and the hoople, to the admiration of all, that he quite forgot to think at all of what was happening to himself. Erstwhile little Tommy Little, now Ermann Schmidt. In the flesh, at least.
You're listening to a presentation from Kettering Fairmont High. If I Were You, we'll continue in just a moment. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from our young and talented cast members. This is 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org.